Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part two on D.B. Cooper. Let's recap a bit from last week's episode. We're in the golden age of skyjacking. At least one skyjacking is happening a week, sometimes two in a day. The public is becoming immune to it. It's such an active occurrence. But I believe these flight attendants and pilots are more on high alert. It's terrifying to think that your plane could get skyjacked at any point, and you are the ones that have to handle the war zone you're in. You're just meant to fly a plane and serve drinks. But in the late 60s and early 70s, you are now tasked with handling weekly skyjackings. In this case, with D.B. Cooper, the most infamous and unsolved skyjacking of all time, a few flight attendants would be in for the trauma of their life. D.B. Cooper, who registered his name as Dan Cooper when he bought his $20 ticket in cash at the Portland airport, bound for Seattle, has become one of legends. The highwayman of the sky. Sources for this episode include the several-part series on the podcast Infamous America, a fantastic podcast, and their sister podcast, Legends of the Old West, is also one of my favorites, so please go check those out. And also an article in Popular Mechanics by Michael Natal, two documentaries called I Am D.B. Cooper and The Mystery of D.B. Cooper, and also Wikipedia. He was a mysterious character, and almost 53 years later, remains a character of lore, a mystery man.
Showing up in all kinds of folk tales and hit songs.
Movies, too. I didn't know that there was a movie Luke just told us about.
Oh, yeah. Without a Paddle.
Yeah. Just, he's everywhere.
Loosely based on D.B. Cooper's story. And then, as Rachel's been researching this, she's also a giant Kid Rock fan.
Yeah, me and Kid Rock have the same hair.
At heart. You should see Rachel... Rachel's rendition of Ball with the Ball,
the Bang to Bang Diggy,
is a sight to behold. And she goes full force when she's listening to it in the truck. Anyhow, we were driving to meet her parents at dinner, and she was just reminiscing, you know, going through childhood jams. And she's like, I used to just love this song. She puts on Ball with the Ball, and sure enough, D.B. Cooper is mentioned in the lyrics.
D.B. Cooper and the money he took.
Pretty awesome. Cue it.
Such good shit.
Rachel's headbanging, holding the microphone to the phone.
Yeah, because you can look for answers, but that ain't fun.
Yeah, well, you know, and searching for D.B. Cooper's answers is quite fun.
Yeah, it is.
We've had a good time.
But Kid Rock wanted him to remain a legend and one of lore, and I appreciate it. However, I do feel for the traumatized people on the plane that day. So let's get back into it, but... thank God for Kid Rock.
Little known folklore, Rachel. Seven Deadly Sinners folklore here. Rachel may or may not be related to Kid Rock.
Yeah, I mean, my mom's maiden name is Richie, and we have the same, like, thin blonde hair. And, you know, I'm a big fan of him. I found your picture today.
Oh, get out of here. All right, moving on.
So, D.B. Cooper was nondescript looking. The FBI described him as, quote, a white male, 6'1", 101 to 175 pounds, age mid-40s, olive complexion, brown eyes, black hair, conventional cut, parted on the left. Dan Cooper was permitted to board his flight unencumbered. No security was in place at this time. You could honestly saunter on a flight like you'd saunter in a grocery store. Think of the movie Blow, where they're trafficking cocaine. He just walked right into the airport with kilos of cocaine, no questions asked. D.B. Cooper did the same, with a seemingly functional bomb. But D.B. Cooper was also calm and collected. So, he's on the plane now. He's in his suit and black tie in the back of the plane. He's already sent his note to the flight attendant, Florence Shatner, saying that he has a bomb. He's ordered a drink from her, a bourbon soda. He pays in cash for that as well. And this mystery man sips his bourbon and soda. He then asks the flight attendant to sit next to him after she reads his note saying that he has a bomb, and he shows her the contents of his briefcase. It's not papers or files. It's not anything other than cylinders, wires, and what looks to be a bomb. She's panic-stricken but remains calm. Sitting next to him while he calmly sips his drink, he is hijacking this plane, and there is not much she can do about it. Her co-flight attendant, Tina, notices something is off. Florence is sitting and spending way too much time with this businessman passenger. Florence isn't a promiscuous gal. She does her job. She keeps her head down. Something is off. This isn't typical behavior for Florence. Tina gets the attention of the third flight attendant, and when Tina approaches Florence, she shows her the note. Tina takes this seriously, and she calls the cockpit. The plane is already over 10,000 feet and pressurized. The captain, last name Scott, is starting to grow concerned. If rapid decompression happens, items could go flying like shrapnel. Brain damage could ensue. People could be sucked out. Especially because D.B. Cooper has a plan to open the cabin door and lower the stairs. He's going to jump and put everyone at risk. But plans change. The airline decides to meet his demands after the flight attendants alert the pilot and they radio down to ground control. He has a bomb in a briefcase and they're confident he's serious, but they haven't been given demands quite yet. So in the rear of the plane, the man explains the situation to Florence. He says he wants $200,000 in a backpack. He wants fuel ready on the ground when they land. And he wants 4 parachutes, 2 front packs, and 2 rear backpacks. And she's furiously scribbling this down. The man then puts on black sunglasses to hide his eyes, but he continues to be calm, but clear, and says he doesn't want any funny business. Then, Florence takes the demands to the cockpit. Tina takes her spot and stays with the hijacker. He demands that Tina stays with him now. And despite the fact that she's recently quit smoking, she shares a cigarette with the man. She lights up his Raleigh cigarettes and has one for herself, and she sits there with him. The pilots have made it clear to their higher-ups that if they don't meet this man's demands, he will detonate this bomb. The other unnerving demand, he says, don't tell the passengers. The hijacker says, don't tell the passengers. So the pilot has to fake it over the intercom. Their flight is going to be about 2 hours longer than normal on a typical 30-minute flight from Portland to Seattle. He must explain why they are circling about the SeaTac airport for over 2 hours. The hijacker also demands they stay in there until his demands are met, but with a deadline of 5 p.m. And then, in his strangest request, he wants meals served to all passengers. So the captain comes over the intercom and says that they are having some minor technical difficulties, but everything will be fine. Meals are served to the passengers as they circle above. But as the 5 p.m. deadline approaches, Seattle banks are scrambling to get the $200,000 together for the airline to meet the hijacker's demands. And meanwhile, the FBI is marking down the serial number of the $20 bills that he demanded. If this guy is serious and his 5 p.m. demand is not met, it could be catastrophic for the passengers on board.
I think it's really smart that he got the passengers fed. You know, nothing just calms a body down like a meal.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was definitely planned, not just to be like goofy or like demanding, or, you know, I think he was definitely, or like a strategy.
Folk hero.
A little bit folk hero maybe, but I think purely strategy, like, I don't want anyone to get uncomfortable.
Yeah. And before you go into what happens with the, you know, pressurization and like if a bomb was to go off or whatever, what's interesting is when I was listening to the Infamous America podcast, he was saying, which I already know that like alcohol hits you stronger when you're, you know, in the air, but your taste buds actually like get more like numb or something.
Oh, really?
Maybe that's why airplane food doesn't. I mean, I am a big fan of snacking while driving, snacking while flying on airplanes.
Pretty much anytime there's an inopportune time to snack, like let's say river rafting. You know, she wants to try, you know.
Let's say when
king crab in the driver's seat.
Yeah, exactly.
Prime rib in the passenger seat. Yeah. These are the things I'm dealing with.
Yeah. I'm ashamed of myself. But anyways. So,
but before I even get to the pressurization of the cabin, another thing that blows my mind just real quick is that you can just rip cigarettes in the fuselage.
Well, I mean,
back
it
in the
was
day.
The 70s.
Wild. Just, I mean, it's like he's got a bomb. He's got a bomb, or does he? That's always been my thing.
Could
he's
cigarettes
just smoking? I mean,
ignite a bomb?
Could
fire? I guess so.
I guess it depends on the bomb.
But you have an electrician background. Could, like, with the plastic wire around it, like, let's say he dropped a cigarette.
Unlikely. There's insulation around the wire that's definitely going to take more time, unless he was already on drugs and not paying attention to the point where he could just keep a lit cigarette on that wire for 30, 60 seconds, you know.
They made it seem like he was extremely calm.
Yeah, I don't think that was
composed.
The case.
Yeah.
I think he was stone cold sober with the exception of the cigs.
Well, and a couple drinks. He'd had a
few. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. California sober.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So rapid decompression. All right, this is what they are afraid of from the crew standpoint.
Yeah, and we were going to interview your pilot friend Andy when he was here for your birthday. So this is why I've decided to have you, because I couldn't get a hold of him today.
Because I was in a band with Andy for over a decade, so basically I can fly planes.
But I think you're better off explaining this than I would be.
True story, I've been in multiple like five-seater Cessnas, small single-engine planes with Andy. I've flown, you know, to Catalina Island, above Los Angeles, all over the state of Indiana, all in these little planes, been through tons of Bloomington, Greenwood, you know, small-time airports and small-time planes and planes of all sorts, and talked to him about it. So, like,
yeah, you're.
I'm just trying to hype me up. I have no clue. I could not.
You're way better to describe this than I am, because I'm like just very thrown off by a lot of the technical
stuff. Andy did
stuff.
Let me fly the plane.
Okay.
There's two
I
steering
don't
wheels.
Hear that. Can you please not?
Like two controls in an airplane. And
okay, great.
He let me. I have flown
great.
A five-seater Cessna.
So you're not going back
Mike
in
November.
A plane with him. Great.
So rapid decompression basically is just as it sounds. When a pressurized system rapidly decompresses due to, you know, a hole or some sort of impact, human error, structural failure of a pressurized vessel. And as we know, when we're up in the air is so thin up there that airplane's fuselage is pressurized. And there's multiple, well, I guess by definition, there's three different types of decompression: explosive, rapid, and gradual. It seems pretty self-explanatory, but anyhow, the big difference is explosive decompression essentially is something where the pressure changes so fast in less than a tenth of a second that there is explosive-like force and...
So like a bomb.
So like a bomb, but the air changes just so quick that you can't even... Your lungs can't even decompress. Like they get sucked out like a vacuum, right? They can't even depress it in real time or the right amount of time. and the air will become like hyper condensed and it'll cool, and so like creating a cloud, a fog will happen, and it'll be sudden condensation, and it'll be like the air is wet. Mm-hmm. You can have terrible trauma, not only to your lungs, but like, yeah, you're basically inside of a bomb.
Brain damage. You can survive,
but you could have brain damage. Your eardrums probably explode. Your eyeballs might get sucked out or sucked in.
Anything that wasn't like any like luggage that wasn't like secured is basically like shrapnel.
Yeah. Oh, projectile. That's the biggest thing is like that amount of force. Like, yeah, like the entire plane easily could be ripped apart, or like a whole rows of seats ripped out. You've probably seen a horror movie or a thriller somewhere where they had a CGI representation of this. But anyways, that's not what happened in this case. In the case of D.B. Cooper.
So the pilot informed the SeaTac air traffic control of the situation, who then contacted the Seattle Police Department and the FBI. And the passengers were told their arrival in Seattle would be delayed because of the minor mechanical difficulty. So the president of the airline at the time was not willing to risk their reputation with a mere $200,000. It was like, we're going to get the banks to get the money together and we are going to meet his demands, because if this guy is serious, if he's going to detonate this bomb, we will be one of the first skyjacking incidences that is deadly.
Yeah, you don't want to be, you know, the airline where the bomb went off.
Exactly.
Bad brand image.
Yeah, exactly. So still, Cooper demands that Tina remain by his side at all times during the flight from Portland to Seattle, and she kind of became his like go-between, okay? So she later said that Cooper appeared familiar with the local terrain. While looking out the window, he remarked, "Looks like Tacoma down there." And I'm from the Pacific Northwest, but Tacoma's—
What's Tacoma?
Right next to Seattle. SeaTac Airport, so Tacoma and Seattle.
Is that where like the Toyota Tacoma comes from?
I have no idea about that.
I bet.
Which put me on the spot, though. But yeah, it's like SeaTac means Seattle-Tacoma Airport. They're right next to each other. So it's as if he'd flew above it before. Like, he kind of knew, or he had maybe planned this. Like, maybe he'd done this route to, like, see.
Oh, yeah. A good skyjacker would have taken the route.
Yeah.
By sky.
At least once before.
At least once. And to have the wherewithal to think, like, I'm going to get everybody a meal. He's been on a plane. This is not his first rodeo.
Yeah.
Even though it might be his first skyjacking.
And he's very specific about his parachutes. And this part kind of confuses me. So when he was told the parachutes were coming from an Air Force base, he correctly noted that McCord was only a 20-minute drive from SeaTac. That's the Air Force base it came from. And Tina later described the hijacker's demeanor as not nervous. He seemed rather nice, and he was not cruel or nasty. So while the airplane circled Seattle, Tina chatted with Cooper and asked why he chose Northwest Airlines to hijack. He laughed and replied, quote, "It's not because I have a grudge against your airlines. It's just because I have a grudge." Then explained the flight simply suited his needs. He asked where she was from. She answered she was originally from Pennsylvania, but was living in Minneapolis at the time. D.B. Cooper responded that Minnesota was very nice country. She asked where he was from, but he became upset and refused to answer. He asked if she smoked and offered her a cigarette, which she replied she had quit but accepted the cigarette. So I'd already said they were sharing a cigarette even after she had quit.
Yeah, you accept the skyjacker's cigarette.
Yeah, and also you're sitting there with him, like, nervous, like he's not letting you leave the seat next to him.
Might as well rip one.
Yeah. And she has been told by him that she will be the one, once they land, that will exit the plane, pick up the bag of money, which mm-hmm. was supposed to be a backpack, but ended up being a duffel bag, which didn't sit kindly
with him.
DB
didn't like.
He did not like that. So
he wanted a JanSport.
Yes. So they land to a very dark SeaTac airport, and the weather is awful. Tina gets off the plane per the skyjacker's request. She picks up the bag of $200,000 in ransom that was received from Seattle's First National Bank that weighed approximately 19 pounds.
Good to know that's how much that weighs.
Yeah. The money in $10,000 unmarked $20 bills, most of which had serial numbers beginning with L, indicating issuance by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. They were photographed by the FBI. Tina then enters back onto the plane. All of the passengers are still on there, and they still don't know why they circled for 2 hours. Because the pilot had, you know, kind of pulled it off with, like, we're having minor...
And there's got to be that one kid, you know, who's, like, already standing in the aisle, already got his luggage out, like, moved up some rows, ready to get off the plane, just being a real...
Yeah. Well, there was actually a cowboy in a cowboy hat that got into, like, a bit of an altercation with D.B. Cooper and Tina. Yeah. And he said to her, if that's a sky marshal or air marshal or whatever, like, we're not having any funny business. Like, I'm sick of this shit. And she was like, we don't have any of those on the plane.
I love it.
Calm it down.
They're just a down old good old rancher ready to punch D.B. right in the schnoz box.
Well, he was just like, the cowboy was kind of just like, I'm bored. Can I get a magazine? Yeah. Can I do something?
Can I get off this plane?
Yeah. We've been circling.
I wrangle cattle from horseback.
It's a 30-minute flight from Portland to Seattle, probably even less. I've done that flight. And he's like, just why are we circling the air for 2 hours? But they still don't know why they've been doing it. They just think it's technical difficulties.
I love the cowboy.
Yeah. So Tina gets off the plane. She goes and retrieves the duffel bag of money, gets back on the plane, passes all the passengers who are clearly irritated and tired or whatever, because DB's in the back seat. So she's walking back and, like, delivers this duffel bag of money to DB Cooper. She then bravely says to him, can you please at least just let these passengers off the plane?
Like, I thought she was going to say, can you please just give me $10,000?
Maybe, listen, there's still so much lore. Maybe she did take some of it. Who knows?
I love it. Okay, so.
So she says, can you please just let these passengers off the plane?
Let my people go.
Yeah. And so he agrees.
Yeah.
And all the passengers get off. The pilot then asks for the two other flight attendants to be let off. They get let off.
What?
But the pilot
Tina stays.
What?
Tina stays.
Yeah, well, because D.B. Cooper wouldn't let Tina go, and the pilots, who, it's said that it's possible that FBI was trying to get them to, like, exit the cockpit. Cockpit, there we go, sorry. By way of, you know, like, through a window and a rope or something, but they were like, we're not going to leave this, like, young flight attendant alone. Like, what? Like, we can't do that. Like, we can't reasonably do that. So it's basically a skeleton crew at this point. It's all the passengers leave. Two of the flight attendants leave. It's Tina.
Captain, first officer, and the skyjacker. Alone on the plane, flying into the dead of night.
After some difficulties with the fuel truck, because remember, he demanded that the plane was completely refueled, they would then refuel in Reno, Nevada, and then he would take off for Mexico City. So there's been a little bit of time on the ground. He also was getting agitated and asked that Tina close all of the window, you know, doors, so like no one could, or window shades or whatever, so no one could see him. Yeah.
So they left SeaTac and went to Reno and refueled before it.
They left SeaTac
to go refuel.
That was where they were. They were essentially headed to Mexico City. But then they're flying over the Columbia River, flying over... The plan was to miss Mount Rainier.
Yeah, you don't want to run into that. It's
because
big.
This is the pilot kind of making this flight plan, whatever.
Okay.
Miss Mount Rainier, you know, and the weather is absolutely awful. And an FAA official requested a face-to-face meeting with Cooper aboard the aircraft, but Cooper denied the request. Cooper became impatient, saying, "This shouldn't take so long, and let's get this show on the road." He then gave the cockpit crew his flight plan and directives. And remember, it's just the skeleton crew. Tina's the only, you know, woman on board. He wanted a southeast course towards Mexico City at a minimum airspeed possible without stalling the aircraft. approximately 100 knots, a maximum of 10,000 feet altitude. He also specified that the landing gear must remain deployed, the wing flaps must be lowered 15 degrees, and the cabin must remain unpressurized.
So this guy knew what he was doing. He had to have, like, flown planes to be that thorough. I mean, I thought I had it figured out, and there are things I didn't think about. But to know those things, like, Andy'd know them.
Yeah.
But if you're not a pilot, like, 100 knots, what does that even mean?
The way I wrote it, I said it should be noted that he was a person who knew way too much about air travel, was either in the military or was a pilot himself or was just good at research.
Now,
I don't know.
I'm changing my mind on him.
I'll
wait till the end, but all of this is changing my mind.
He also requests his four parachutes he requests. Two of them are normal. Two of them are ones that cannot, you can't maneuver them. You know, you can't, I can't.
Drive them, steer them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they don't have the handles.
Yeah, and when he's getting frustrated when back up in the air, he starts cutting strips of one of the ones that can't be maneuvered. Seemingly because he was delivered, not in a JanSport, he was delivered his money in a, you know, duffel bag. Maybe he was trying to strap those two
tie
himself.
It. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because from Martin McNally's folly, you know, that's like, as we were talking about, the decompression, whether it's explosive or rapid, like rapid decompression, like it's, you can barely hold on to something. You know, you can't just strap it. You need to handcuff it to yourself. It needs to be tied to your body, secured tightly, double locked. You know, like there's going to be so much force on it. You can't just hold on to something and jump out of a plane.
Yeah, like and he wouldn't be experienced enough to really, unless he was. That's what the enduring mystery of this is. So.
Yeah, my opinion's shifting.
It's
I always wondered about. I thought he just tore up the parachute to like be like, haha, you guys can't parachute out after me. If one of them was, you know, trained military or something, that's literally what I thought. But now I realize it probably was just using it for like rope.
Yeah, like something to attach himself to, and he was jumping out in extreme bad weather. I mean, the Pacific Northwest is terrible weather, and it was over like a severely thick forested area. No, it was extremely dangerous. So he tells Tina to go back up to the cockpit. He asks her before that, though, like, how do I open the stairs? And she said, it's pretty simple. It's just a lever. Whatever. But it's dangerous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the cockpit recognizes that the pressure has lowered.
They're losing pressure.
Yeah, they're losing pressure. But he does tell Tina, go up there. She goes up. She closes the first class curtains, gets into the cockpit, and they call back to him a few times. They don't hear anything. Pressure goes down even more. They're realizing most likely he has opened the stairs. So he at least, spared their lives. You know, like he told Tina to go up, you know.
Yeah, he didn't want her flying out.
Yeah.
Didn't want blood on his hands.
Yeah. And eventually it just goes silent. And D.B. Cooper jumps in the dead of night into the Pacific Northwest wilderness and is seemingly never seen again. But his investigation goes on for, 53 years. There's a blackjack player who in 2020, I read an article, who is like, he thinks he has like, he's like a citizen sleuth has solved this. There was an 8-year-old boy, you know, I don't know, in the 90s, who found thousands of dollars floating in the river that were D.B. Cooper's.
So here's my new theory. All right, one, at first I thought like, yes, the rapid decompression might have sucked him out too fast. He wasn't prepared. He wasn't educated or aware enough on what was going to happen when that back hatch comes down. But now I disagree. And the reality is that it's such a big hole that the pressure would actually bounce out fairly quickly, and at least quick enough, or slowly enough, rather, that you'd be able to, while breathing would be hard, if you were trained, you can train to, you know, be cognizant in, you know, this type of rapid decompression. And so I'm thinking that he was cognizant of what was going to go on, was prepared, and released himself from the plane under his own volition. And then I think, here's the new curveball. He dropped the money on purpose. He threw some money out so they would think
that he died.
That he died.
Because the FBI does, like, their, I think their final, their final theory is that he would not have been able to survive those conditions and jumping into the Pacific Northwest wilderness, and that there's no way he could have survived. But
new,
there's
new part of my theory. The grudge is the Air Force. That's why he knew where the base was.
The grudge was there. Well,
he wanted to be in their airspace.
Here's what's funny though too, is when the flight left SeaTac and was going like south towards Mexico City, they had fighter jets tracking it, but the fighter jets were not designed to go as slow as, because the plane had to go very slow.
Somebody
to be
knows
at the 10,000.
I bet he had a buddy in the Air Force who was in one of those fighter jets. When he got out, he was like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to fuck you.
I don't know.
I'm going to make you have to get out of bed and go in your jet and come looking for me, and you're never going to find me.
But they couldn't keep track of him because they're not designed to go that slow. So if the plane was at such a low, you know, like 10,000 feet or whatever.
Altitude and airspeed.
They have
only
to go
100
very,
knots. That's
they
like,
have to go very slow, and fighter jets are not designed to do that,
exactly.
So they were losing track of him.
The old tortoise and the hare plan. This guy had it figured out.
Honestly, it's very fascinating, and I would like to do a third part and do Martin McNally, and I'd like to, like...
His proteges?
At the beginning of the next episode, I'd like to explain, you know, the theories on who he could be, the people that, you know, admitted that they were maybe D.B. Cooper, you know, all the like weird conspiracy theories, because people became obsessed with this. And then the other skyjackings, like the Martin McNally, the other
love
ones.
Martin McNally.
Yeah, so we're doing another skyjacking episode.
We this just can't get enough skyjacking. I love skyjacking. I was actually going to think maybe for next episode, we could even go to a small airport and see if we can skyjack.
And skyjack. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know? Just for like snacks, though. Like king crab and prime rib.
I want the cheese box. I want the whatever it's called, the market.
Like everybody's getting fed on this plane, or else we ain't taking off.
And I would like a mini bottle of red wine that I don't accept a cup for because I don't like how that lip gets the wine under it.
Oh come
and
on!
And I just drink it from the thing.
Airplane cups.
Yeah.
Get a deal with Solo. Yeah.
No, those have a lip too.
Oh. Well,
you can't drink that with red wine.
I'm not as experienced.
Well, anyways, this is where we're at with D.B. Cooper. It's still unsolved. People still think that he possibly was alive. I mean, we don't know. But we're going to do one more skyjacking episode.
At the beginning of this, I really thought that he, one, died. And two, thought that, you know, he probably had some military experience, but like was probably a bit unhinged to be doing this. Desperate. Why was he so desperate? Desperate times.
But he seemed calm, they said.
Well, I'm saying I'm reworking this. I feel like this is more like a retired Air Force man who was doing this to like prank his friend. And he'd been thinking about it for 10 years to get his, whatever, his subordinate or his superior.
I love that you think he's pranking his friend to do something that extreme.
That's the only thing that I think drives a man to be this thorough.
It's
a good, well thought out prank.
Listen, I love your theories.
He had a flight plan.
Listen, I love your theories, and I love this subject, and I hope you guys do too. And thank you so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And until next week, sorry, we're doing one more skyjacking. I'm just too fascinated
sorry,
with it now.
Sorry, not sorry.
Thank you, Greg.
You're going to like Martin McNally.
Yep. All right, love you guys. Bye. Thank you.